This is Terry Crosby,
Andy Steiger,
Steve Kim.
Welcome to the AC Podcast. On this podcast, we want to help you understand and speak the language of our culture and address questions being asked with intellectual honesty, gentleness, and respect. We're back for another week. Welcome, listeners. Welcome, Steve. Welcome, hello. Andy.
Good to be here.
So we're going to be talking about a very interesting subject today, but I'm going to start it off with just a couple of jokes for you guys.
Some jokes?
Yes.
All right.
Yes. What do you call a cat? Does it take a screw and a light bulb? They could worry the banana. You don't like that one?
I don't even know if I heard it correctly.
This is another one.
I don't
think
I understood that.
What did the new ant say after a dog? It was a pirate. You don't like that one?
Am I missing something?
Yeah, I'm not really catching on either.
Okay, one more. One more. Well, there's a few more, but I'll do one more. What do you call a pastor cross the road? He take the chicken. No, you guys are not. That's not making you laugh.
Okay, hold on. I have a sneaky suspicion that this is some sort of computer trying to tell a joke.
Yes,
am I right?
Yeah. So there's a neural network woman that her name's Janelle Shane, and she's trained the next generation neural network to write one line jokes.
Well, she's failed epically.
Yes.
I'll tell you that right now.
She actually plugged in about 43,000 jokes into the database. And whatever they do, she created some kind of machine learning algorithm as well. And this was the result.
What a great illustration, actually, of what AI is, what it can and what it cannot do.
Yes.
Which is the subject of this show.
The subject of this show. So I thought I'd lead it off with that. You guys didn't even crack anything. Like
those are worse than my kids' jokes.
Right on. So today we're going to talk about AI, what it can do and what it cannot do. So let's get into it. Actually, I have one quote from a guy named Herbert Simon in 1957. He said, "It is not my aim to surprise or shock you, but the simplest way I can summarize is to say that there are now in the world machines that think, that learn, and that create. Moreover, their ability to do these things is going to increase rapidly until, in a visible future, the range of problems they can handle will be coextensive with the range to which human mind has been applied." So that was 1957. And he
wrote
was
that in 1957. What actually a great illustration of a phenomenon that continues to happen within technology. And that is that often there is this sci-fi kind of element where you kind of have these individuals that are really more of these prophets within the tech era that are more futuristic looking and really that use a lot of hyperbole and in particular seek to shine technology to look a little better than it is. Now, listen, I've got a friend of mine and I love him dearly. His name's Brian. Ever since we were little kids, he's always been one of those guys, you know, hey, technology can do this and it'll do that in the future. And really just talking about it in ways that give it the benefit of the doubt. It's kind of like talking about Siri and that Siri, how great she is, how you can just talk to your phone and it'll dial whoever you want it to dial. You know, all you got to do is say their name until all of a sudden you grab a phone, those that have actually tried talking to Siri to dial somebody, and it dials, you know, somebody whose name isn't even remotely similar to the one you just told it, or tells you, "I'm sorry, I don't understand. Can you repeat it 5 times? To which you throw your phone out the window. Do you know what I'm saying? It's one of those things.
No, I got Android. I don't understand. It does not compute.
Steve, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
My OK Google does not even work.
So what I'd love to do with this show is just break it down for people and explain what actually is AI, what can it do, what can't it do? Because, I mean, that quote from the 50s to say that that was an exaggeration is an understatement, especially in the 50s, let alone with where we're at currently with regards to what machines can and can't do. I think maybe a helpful place to start with this whole investigation is just to kind of go back to the beginning and bring people up to speed on where we're at currently. The idea of creating machines, and in particular human-type machines, really goes back to the Enlightenment, where you got people like Descartes. He develops this thing called dualism, where he says, maybe we can take a human being and look at them as both a body and a mind. He wanted to do that because he really wanted to focus in on a human being as just a body, and in particular as a mechanical, biological machine that could be reduced, studied, and understood. You know, as we went into that project, we really began to view humans more and more as machines. And so it's not surprising that as the Enlightenment unfolds and we continue on, we get in the 17th century, we get words being coined like android, which is Greek for manlike. And there's this shift begins to take place where we stop just making machines that help people, and we begin to start making machines to be people. And that's an important shift that begins to take place in the 17th and 18th century. And in particular, you see this with different machines that are created. Two of my favorites, and there's a great book, by the way, called The Restless Clock, if you'd like to go deeper into the subject. But two of my favorites is there's a machine that's created to play the flute. And in doing so, we learned a lot about the mechanics of music through that. And one of the things that's really interesting that was a problem that is still being worked on in many ways, but we're getting a whole lot better at it now, is that when you move from one note to another, there actually requires different levels of air pressure to do that, depending upon what note you're going to another from. And this affects how voices sound. And we're able to do this tacitly as human beings, but machines have a difficult time doing it, impossible time for a long time. So that's why they had a machine-sounding voice, is because they weren't able to adjust their air pressure to change from whatever note they ended on or whatever word they're talking about to the next one that they're going into. So it taught us things, is my point there. Another one of my favorite machines is a machine called the Turk from the 18th century. And this was a machine that was created to play chess. And this machine taught us that, you know, there's a difference between body mechanics and mind mechanics. So here you got this machine that's trying to play, you know, it's playing chess with people, and does, by the way, it's being paraded all over the place at that time, plays Benjamin Franklin, it plays Napoleon, beats both of them, you know, and people were just, you know, mind blown kind of thing, until they realized that there was just a dude hidden in a box, you know, and then they're like, you know, wait a minute. Like,
I was trying to figure that out. Okay. I got it.
You know, right. And you can actually go online and see how they, you know, hid this guy in there. And I thought about this too. I'm like, that must have just sucked, you know, for this guy in this hot, sweaty box as he's somehow trying to play chess at the same time. And amazingly, he won. So, I mean, kudos to that guy, you know, being in a box and winning at chess. But these days, as you and I know, you don't need to hide people in a box anymore. Now what we're hiding in the box, if you will, is cleverly devised algorithms. When we're talking about AI, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about algorithms in particular, because we're talking about that intelligent component of a human being, and that's why it's called artificial intelligence, which raises some really important questions. Now, I want to make a distinction before we get too deep into this that I'm sure you guys are familiar with, and that is that there's a distinction between weak AI and strong AI. And the distinction that's being made there, and this is a distinction that was coined by John Searle, and that is that weak AI is simply just imitating the, you know, thinking. It's imitating what people are doing. Whereas strong AI is more of an ontological claim in which it's being understood as thinking, so that the machine now on strong AI is being ontologically, or to use a simpler word the machine is being understood as a mind. So, you know, in the weak version, it's imitating it. In the strong version, it is it.
Would you say that it's kind of like, how people think of your brain, right? So for example, you know, your brain on the physical level is just really a bunch of particles colliding at the end of the day. But then a lot of, for example, atheists and physicalists will say that, but then there's this emergent property that arises out of the brain called the mind. And so in a sense, the brain is really identical to the mind. Would you say that's a kind of a, that's the idea?
Yeah. For some people, and I would say that there's going to be a variance, obviously, of opinion on this, but there's people in the philosophy of mind that have this idea that when you reach a certain level of complexity, neural complexity, that consciousness manifests itself. And so the idea is kind of extrapolated onto artificial intelligence that, or, you know, machines, that if a certain level of complexity is reached, well, then this emergent property we call consciousness or the mind should manifest itself. It's why you get movies that have this idea, you know, where a machine suddenly takes on personhood, right? You know, this consciousness that tends to be maniacal, right? And is going to destroy the earth.
Or at least it seems, at least on the outside appearance, it looks like this thing has achieved consciousness, right? Because, I mean, in a sense, you can't really know that this thing has achieved consciousness unless you have that first person perspective.
Right. And that's a good pushback, Steve, because that becomes an important counter argument within all of this. And that's the question. And we're going to get farther down this road. You know, if you're imitating thinking, what then becomes the difference between imitating something and actually thinking? So you're this distinction between imitating thinking and actually thinking. This becomes a difficult distinction in some ways to make. And it's a similar distinction that's made in philosophy of mind with regards to how do I know that there's other people in the world, right? I'm looking at Terry right now and thinking to myself, is Terry human? Sometimes I wonder. You know, but basically this idea, you know, is Terry experiencing everything that I'm experiencing?
It's interesting. I was just doing a little reading on this before we came in here, and there's this guy named Hans Moravec. Do you know him?
I haven't heard of him.
Hans Moravec, Moravec's paradox. And he talks almost about the evolution of machines in the sense of the mind.
Okay.
And he basically says, if we give them enough things to work over time, like as humans, the easiest things we come to do, we've done for millions of years, according to him, right? So the ones that we don't know and new to us, we have to work at. So he's bringing in the whole evolution piece with the machine and their mind and hoping in the future that it is going to bring it closer together with the human mind.
Well, and we're going to get deeper into that, this concept, you know, that there's certain mechanical things that humans do. There's even more kind of instinctual things that humans do. There's certain things that people do that we aren't even conscious of. For example, our heart's beating, our lungs are breathing, those sorts of things happen very mechanically. So in one sense, those sorts of things are easy to replicate. However, there's these other things, and I'm guessing what he would see as more evolved features of our humanity, in which we're able to do things that are difficult to replicate, such as, and this gets back to the point we were in, such as feeling pain. So I can make a machine that can pretend to be in pain, right? Or to show the behavior of pain. But is that the same thing as actually being in pain?
Right.
Now, you know, there's a philosopher out there named Thomas Nagel who wrote a very famous article on this point. It's a point actually that Wittgenstein makes as well. The article he wrote is, what was it like to be a bat? And his whole point on that is, you know, you can imitate what it's like to be a bat. You can even imagine what it's like to be a bat, but that is a completely different beast than actually being a bat. And so these though are kind of pushbacks to artificial intelligence. I want to just continue though in this thinking on what it actually is, just to help people out that right now, I mean, we're hearing all sorts of things about artificial intelligence, and it's really being used now commercially to get you to buy different products or to get involved in different aspects of life that are going to be seen as being enhanced by artificial intelligence. So on that note, then it's kind of good to demystify, you know, what it actually is. What are these algorithms actually doing, and why is it being called AI? To answer that question, I think it's important to understand that continuing in this journey that we've been on, you know, where we go from creating machines that play the flute to creating machines that can try to play chess. In 1950, Alan Turing, who, you know, the father of modern day computing in many ways, he came up with this idea after being in a dialogue with Michael Polanyi. Now, that's why some people might be like, Andy, how do you know so much about all this? Because I've been doing my PhD on Michael Polanyi, and Michael Polanyi and Alan Turing are in communication on this. This is something they dialogue back and forth at when they're both working at Manchester University in the UK. It's kind of neat for those of you who know about Alan Turing that Polanyi's the one who encouraged him to publish his work. And Polanyi's the one who helped organize a lot of these dialogues on this subject of can machines think? Now, Polanyi's pushback to Turing on regards to the subject of can a machine think is a lot of the things that you and I have just been talking about. Polanyi is very much wanting to challenge this kind of reductionistic thinking that just reduces a human being to a body, that reduces a human being to a brain. And Polanyi wants to argue that there is this thing called tacit knowledge, and that is that there's like these two different forms of knowledge. There's this explicit form of knowledge that can be coded for, those sorts of mechanical things that we do that can be specified in an explicit step-by-step function, such as walking, for example. You're putting one leg in front of the other. However, there is this tacit or silent knowledge, though, that's taking place as well, where we have an equilibrium and whatnot, and it's doing all sorts of functions, very high, you know, functions that we're unaware of. And so you kind of have these two different things taking place. You've got this, you know, mechanical function that's taking place, but then you've got this tacit function that's taking place that can't be specified in a specific, you know, step-by-step function. And a famous example of this is going back to the Turk, and that is chess. Chess is a great example of a game that humans play that, yes, it has instructions, but there isn't a way that you can code a computer to play chess at a high level. You can explicitly code it at some degree, but then you quite quickly realize that the game gets far too complex and there's too many different variables to be able to explicitly tell a machine how to play chess. And so this really became a dividing line between what would just be a machine and what would be artificial intelligence. And that would be, can we create machines? Can we create algorithms that can teach a machine how to do these tacit features? And Polanyi argued, no, you can't. And the reality is that we found is he was right. You can't teach a machine how to do these explicit things step by step. But what you can do is you can code a machine to learn how to do those things. And that's what's called machine learning. And that's something that people probably heard a lot about.
So we can only put in as much as we know, basically.
That's right.
Right.
We can only put in as much as we know or can specify.
And the hope is that eventually they will become more human-like in the future.
But that becomes the problem, Terry, is you can't explicitly state what is human-like.
Okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. You know, we can only point to examples of it.
Yeah.
And that's where Turing, after getting pushed back by Polanyi, began to realize, oh, we can't explicitly state these sorts of things. This becomes Polanyi's paradox. We know more than we can tell. And so Turing, the very next year, so that dialogue took place in 1949. In 1950, that is when Turing published his famous paper in which he argued for something called the imitation game. And in the imitation game, Turing said, okay, if we can't code for something explicit like thinking, well, what if we imitate the behavior of thinking? And that's where you get this whole concept of artificial intelligence and particularly strong AI. And that idea that, well, if you can code a machine that can imitate it, to such a degree, and this is his point, to such a degree that they convince you that they're a person, well, then surely they must be a person. It starts out as this imitation game. We don't have time to get into all of that, but ultimately it gets coined as the Turing test.
So, yeah, when you talk about the Turing test, all that pops into my mind is Blade Runner, right? So you go back to
Blade Runner or Ex Machina is another famous one.
Right, and you can see exactly what
– those are movies, by the way.
Movies, way back when, that you can actually kind of witness the idea of the Turing test.
Oh, and this is kind of something interesting, because some people might be like, wow, this, you know, this conversation, what does this actually have to do with, you know, everyday life? Well, virtually every, you know, movie that's come out in the last number of years that's on technology is all playing off of the Turing test. You see this quite regularly. And in fact, it gets mentioned in different ways. But if you haven't read the different material, it can be difficult for you to see what the directors and the writers are doing. But they're all playing off of these ideas. These are important concepts in our right. world today.
Yeah, yeah. Now, one thing that I am very curious about this Turing test is, I mean, for me, it doesn't sit with me quite right, because it seems to me that Alan Turing is making this jump from the phenomenon, like so what you see on the outside, and then he makes the jump, it seems to me, to tell you what it actually is. So if it passes the Turing, I guess that's my question is, so what if you pass the Turing test? What does it mean, right? So let's say a machine convinces you that this is a human being, for example, as you're having this text-based conversation, the machine says everything just the right way so as to convince you that this is a person that you're texting back and forth with. Does that mean this machine is now a person?
Strong AI would say yes.
Right. So that's where I'm thinking, okay, he seems to be making this unwarranted jump between phenomenology to ontology. So what the outer appearance is, or what it looks like, what it seems to be doing, to what it is. Like, how does he make that jump?
This becomes problematic, because as we've been making machines that can come closer and closer to passing the Turing test, we're more and more aware that the machine's just playing a game that we've coded it to play, and that we're feeling more and more uncomfortable saying, well, that machine is in fact a person because it can mimic person behavior. There are many arguments against what you're getting at there, Steve, that to make this ontological jump. And one of the arguments, though, that's made, you know, there's many, and that is, before they even go as far as you're going, Steve, they would just say that there seems to be inherent problems with the Turing test even to begin with, such as I could imagine being in a conversation with a person in which it's advantageous for them to be silent. You
right.
know, we call this pleading yeah. the fifth, right? We can especially see this in a court of law. So you could imagine, though, that there could be a situation in which a conversation between a machine and a person in which the machine, it's advantageous for them to remain silent. And in doing so, they could conceivably pass the Turing test. Mm-hmm. Again, though, would we feel comfortable saying that that's a person? Now, on the flip side, what you have is you actually have human beings that can't pass the Turing test. Mm-hmm. That becomes an ontological problem as well. So you've got children that couldn't pass it. You have disabled people that can't pass it. Now, does that mean that they're not human?
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting what you said earlier when Terry was telling all these jokes that these computers made. You said, Andy, like, these are worse than my kids' jokes, implying that, you know, there is a level of jokes that our children tell that it's not quite up to the level of the sophistication that grownups can achieve, that sort of thing. I mean, I hear some of those jokes that these machines spat out, and I'm thinking to myself, I could potentially hear my 3-year-old son saying something like that. Mm-hmm. In which case, if you apply the Turing test, then what happens to my son?
That's right. Now, on an interesting side note, for those of you who have children, you're well aware that there's an interesting level of intelligence involved in understanding a joke. I'm amazed at how many movies I've watched with my kids where the joke just goes right on over their head, right? So on the one sense, there's this idea of, you know, intelligence required to understand a joke. But on the other end, and this is where things get problematic, is there's the intentionality of telling a joke, of the pun. And this becomes really challenging in this distinction between weak AI and strong AI, and we can actually make this distinction between weak tacit knowledge and strong tacit knowledge. And I want to get into that distinction now, where intentionality begins to take root. What I want to get into is back in, you know, the 70s and particularly the 80s, there were a number of algorithms that were written. And I was kind of surprised by this. I thought a lot of these, you know, machine learning algorithms are a more modern phenomenon. They're not. They've been written and thought of a long time ago. And by machine learning algorithms, I'm talking about things like a confusion matrix, a Monte Carlo algorithm. And now these days we're into things called neural networks and deep learning and whatnot. But what's interesting about these algorithms is that, you know, as we're moving from, again, from creating this machine where you have to hide a person in there, and now we're putting algorithms in there, and we've already got this understanding that we've got this Polanyi's paradox that we can't code things explicitly, such as playing chess. Well, then how do you create a machine that can play chess? And the answer is these machine learning algorithms are coded. This is where Polanyi, I think, was just mistaken. And that was that you can actually code a machine to learn how to play chess. And that's exactly what we've done through these different algorithms, is that the machine is learning this, you know, if you will, weak form of tacit knowledge where they're able to do things like play chess. And in fact, IBM's computer, what was it called, Deep Blue, beat, you know, Garry Kasparov, the reigning champion at chess. And so that was monumental. I mean, not only was the machine playing chess, but the machine was beating the best human chess player. And these algorithms have only become more sophisticated, as in 2011, when Watson, by IBM, beat the two reigning Jeopardy champions. And then in 2016, when you've got Google's AlphaGo program that beat Lee Sedol from, you know, from Steve from your homeland, yep, beat him 4-1. And I'm sure, Steve, I know you read Korean news. I would guess that that was big news.
Oh, it was totally big news. And there were a lot of eyes watching the game.
And we should probably specify the game is called Go. I don't know.
Yeah. And Go is a very ancient game, right? So if our listeners have never seen it played, basically what you have is it's kind of like chess, but you have this board and you have all these, like, basically you have a grid, and it's a game of trapping the opponent to take away their stones, kind of thing. So one player has all the black stones, the other player has all the white stones, and you take turns placing one after another. And it's a strategically very, very complex game, and people spend years studying this. Just
now, in Asia, it's a much more popular game, right?
Mm-hmm. Very, very popular, and it's held in very high esteem.
So a lot of people thought there's no way that a machine's ever going to be able to beat, you know, a human at Go, because it's so complex. It's vastly more complex than chess, given how many potential moves are on the board. And the way that AlphaGo was able to beat Lee Sedol was, actually, by the way, Steve has explained to me that in Korea, they actually put their last name first and then their first name. So his name's actually Sedol Lee. The way that this program was able to beat him was by playing versions of itself and virtual versions of people. And in doing so, was able to have a lot more games and take in a lot more data, which is going to be key. I'll mention this in a moment. And ultimately is able to beat him. Nowadays, there's a new version called AlphaGo Zero that beat the original AlphaGo program 100-0.
Wow.
So you could only imagine how complex that one is. And again, the way that one got so good is by playing itself again. And that one, by the way, is a unique program. It learned how to play AlphaGo from scratch. So it taught itself how to play from playing, which I think is an example of tacit knowledge. The problem is, though, and this is where things get interesting, is I would argue that this is a weak form of tacit knowledge and not a strong form of tacit knowledge. So I think what we're seeing right now with artificial intelligence is that artificial intelligence is learning from, by the way, they learn from the brain, these neural networks, of taking in, and this is important, this is how it works. And this is why, by the way, we had the algorithms in the 80s, but we are just now seeing artificial intelligence. And that is that you need to be able to take in vast amounts of data, which our mind's able to do. You take in vast amounts of data, and these what are called hidden variables within neural networks need to be assigned ever greater, you know, accuracy. These numbers become more and more accurate as the data is being processed. So you've got an input of data, you've got these hidden variables that are being fine-tuned, and then you've got the output of whatever it is that you're seeking to do, whether or not that's play chess, ride a bike, or whatever that might be. So it's learning from its failure. So in its failure, you know, you could say that hidden variable could be whatever number you want at the beginning, right? But the output's going to be failure. So as it keeps taking in data and those variables continue to be more and more fine-tuned, those hidden variables, the output gets closer and closer to the desired result. Now, this then has implications in that the machines, these artificial intelligent machines, are able to do what humans want them to do. You got to know what the output is. And they're able to then use these algorithms to do those things that we can't specify. But again, this is a big jump, ontological jump, then to say that that's what the mind is. Because mm-hmm. we would say that there's more to that, and this is, gets to this strong form of tacit knowledge, that there is something that it is to be a human being. Again, it's different to be able to code for the behavior of pain. I actually know what it's like to be in pain. This first person experience, this understanding of intentionality, of desire, of the experience of the thing. At any rate, I bring all that up just to say that as we continue to see artificial intelligence used more and more in day-to-day life, that we need to be careful that we're not jumping to those ontological conclusions about what it is and to say that a machine is a human being. Now, because I want to just state this, because I think this is important. Ray Kurzweil has predicted that by the year 2030, a machine will pass the Turing test. And I think he's right. I think that by 2030, a machine will be able to pass a weak form of the Turing test. And a weak form, I mean, maybe a text version. That a machine, given enough data, which, by the way, the internet has been huge for this, given enough data of potential human responses to questions, it can imitate intentionality, right? And it can imitate the right kinds of answers to the right kinds of questions. Again, that's a big difference, though, than to say that it is a human being. And this is an important thing for us to be talking about because we're living in a time right now. We are so used to anthropomorphizing things, giving things human characteristics, that human beings are just jumping at the opportunity to say that these machines are persons. And we saw this, as you guys, I know we've talked about before, with Sophia. Right, this machine that was shown in Saudi Arabia in 2017 at a tech summit and was granted citizenship there in Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. And I mean, a big question we've got to ask ourselves is, do we actually want to be granting citizenship to humanity, to a machine that can imitate behaviors of persons? Now, this part that's scary to me is if you've seen any video of Sophia, she can't pass the Turing test. She's so far from even potentially passing a Turing test. It's concerning to me that yet still she was granted citizenship. I mean, that to me just shows how eager people are to want to, you know, grant personhood without thinking through the implications of what is going to transpire, you know, if we were to do that, let alone people's ignorance to different philosophical arguments that's already been made in the area of philosophy of mind, such as Thomas Nagel's, you know, What It's Like to Be a Bat, that clearly demonstrates that even if you were to have a machine that could imitate, you know, being a human to the extreme, such as Blade Runner, that's probably the biggest extreme that I can think of, mm-hmm. where it's very difficult to see the distinction between machine and human. Right. Still on his article, What It's Like to Be a Bat, and these different philosophical arguments we could make, we could still show that it's a machine that has some sort of ontological status for sure, but it's not a human being. It would be something else. It would be, you know, this machine. which we don't have time to get into it today. And I think that we're going to follow this podcast up with another podcast. Polanyi would argue that you define a thing not by its parts, but by its purpose. And so on that, if anybody's wondering, the way that I define a machine that can pass the Turing test is to say that what you've got there is a successful human mimicking machine. That's what it is.
Just to clarify, too, if our listeners are still wondering, why is Andy singing this tune so loudly? It's because when we anthropomorphize animals and machines, you know, not just kind of in a Lion King kind of a way where we give human characteristics to animals for the purpose of entertainment, that sort of thing. But when we actually start making claims that this is a human being, what ends up happening is that we're not really raising machines to the level of human persons. What we're doing actually is, it's a symptomatic of what we've already been doing, is that we've actually reduced human beings down to the level of the machine.
That's right.
Because we did away with the idea of God culturally, right? And that this is the death of God that Nietzsche was warning atheists of his time, right? We did away with the idea of God as a culture. And then what ends up happening is not only did God die, humanity died. We don't know what we are anymore. And so we can then look at something like an AI and go, okay, that has the potential of being a human being. Because again, we did away with the idea of God. Now we don't know who we are. And so, of course, whatever we can anthropomorphize, right? Why not call it a human being when it can mimic our behavior perfectly?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been prepping for a talk I'm giving in Switzerland at the World Congress on the topic of artificial dignity. You know, one of the topic at the World Congress this year is human dignity and how can we understand what it is and argue for it. And so part of my argument is that people need to be careful with this artificial intelligence because they're going to undermine human dignity instead of promote human dignity. And so there's some important implications that we need to be aware of because they're going to have future implications and actually quite quickly.
Very good. Andy, that was some deep knowledge.
I see what you did there.
Thank you. Thank you.
A little deep learning taking place there.
And listeners, you can hear the passion, I think, in Andy's voice because he's been doing this for, looking into this, researching for a number of years now. You still got 2 years left.
1 year.
1 year?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. It's coming closer.
I'm just kidding.
Nice.
Dr. Steiger coming up.
Yeah, coming up.
I should be done about this time next year.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, that's been great. We appreciate you listeners for joining us again. And we'll come back next week and we'll have another hot topic to discuss. The AC Podcast is a ministry of Apologetics Canada. And we'll come back next week with more things to think about.